Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of the Innovation Crush. I've actually never put a "the" in front of Innovation Crush. So, how did it sound? Did it sound good to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
That's right.
The Innovation Crush. My name is Chris Denson, your gracious host. In case you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things ideas, marketing, creativity, business, smart people doing smart things. And today, that ball continues rolling. Hello, Eden Chin.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. I just got in from San Francisco. And
How long ago was just?
I literally got in like maybe an hour and 30 minutes ago. Stopped by my brother's house and then came straight here.
I appreciate you for making the trek and being a timely sport.
No worries.
And you actually have a sports sweatshirt on, so that's.
I love sports.
I love sports. That'll be the quote for this interview. Be like, I love sports. Eden Chin, Fisherman Labs. So before I start rambling on, why don't you tell the people a little bit of the 90-second version of who you are?
Yeah, so I grew up in Maryland, right outside D.C., like maybe 20 minutes from D.C. My mom was a Radiohead or a journalist.
She wasn't in Radiohead.
No.
Okay.
That would be awesome.
Just quite distinction. Just
the Asian lady in Radiohead. You know her.
Yeah, you remember like the fifth Beatles.
Yeah. My dad was a musician, classical composer. So grew up in a very non-traditional Asian family. And then went to Emory for school and wanted to be a youth pastor actually at the time. And when I was 19, I started to trade stocks and I got into it because I wanted to make some money so that I could pay for my expensive private school, and ended up doing a lot better than I thought I would. And that kind of rolled into post-school and work, and then ended up starting a hedge fund out in Los Angeles. Did that for about a year and a half, and then kind of got a little tired of...
How does one start a hedge fund?
Well, there's a couple ways you could do it. One is something...
Oh, let me get my pen out.
Huh?
Let me get my pen.
Oh, yeah. So 10 divided by 11 times 7. No.
I say that in jest, but like coming out of college, you know, right. Like you said, you started at 19, you were doing well, you're at a private school. What did you study at Emory?
I studied business. I was actually originally in the seminary, so I was like... you know, 19 years old, 18 years old, and everybody else was like 30 plus. It's like super intimidating. We're like studying Greek and Hebrew and stuff, and got into the finance stuff just kind of out of almost like a mistake. Got into trading, and then back to your question, there's kind of a couple ways you can start a fund. One is you raise money and, you know, work with institutional investors, and that is very, very difficult for someone that is young. Especially the finance industry is kind of a old boys club in a lot of ways. So real estate, oil, hedge fund, I mean, those are industries generally where you don't see a lot of innovation in terms of like young people coming in and disrupting things. So, I mean, even when I was right out of school, I went and did investment banking. And when I told people I was going to go start a hedge fund, people were like, you're crazy. Like, that's stupid. we had run a fund in college and basically had talked with four founders, or me and three other people, about starting a fund post, working for a year or two. And one of the partners had done very, very well, had extremely good performance. Two of us had traded together as well in college. And then the fourth partner was a professor at Emory. So he had been around for a while. He was in his, you know, late 40s, early 50s kind of thing, and, brought a lot of the institutional experience. And we started mainly as a proprietary fund, meaning we were trading our own capital.
Right.
And did that for a couple of years. The goal was like, let's build a track record and then we'll go out to institutional investors and raise money.
How do you respond to the haters? Especially like like you said, there was a big age gap while you were, you know, learning and working, but then you decided to do it on your own. And they're like, then it was really ha-ha. How does Eden Chin respond to opposition in that context?
Yeah, I mean, I always think like, I don't necessarily care what people think that much in general. So I try not to listen to all the noise, but you know, for me, it was it was humbling in a lot of ways because we didn't do very well when we started the fund. So, you know, we ran it for 2 years. I had personally made some money, so I had money saved up, and you know, had seen a lot of success in trading in the past. But when I actually started the fund, we ran into a lot of issues. We had one of our partners was going through some personal stuff, and he kind of, you know, stopped showing up to the office. And he was a key member of what we were doing. Two of us were very young, and we just didn't have a lot of discipline, too.
Right.
And the fourth partner was part-time teaching in Atlanta. And so we didn't do bad. We just didn't do enough. And so in some ways it was like, well, maybe people are right, you know?
So
it was humbling in a lot of ways, but it was an amazing experience, still. And so, yeah, that's kind of,
yeah, no, that's great. So kind of fast forward, right? You've been through some ventures and adventures, if you will. Forbes 30 Under 30, congratulations. It's this year, right?
Yeah, I guess they just announced maybe 2 weeks ago or something.
Yeah, way to humble brag. Just kidding. Tell us a little bit about Fisherman Labs and what it is and what you do there and, you know.
So we originally got started, Charles and I met Charles at a church I was going to. I'd pulled out of the hedge fund after about a year and a half, spent a year kind of reorienting myself with software development, which was kind of something that I did in high school. And Charles had been doing software development for 20 years. We met and we just got along in friendship, business, and we were like, how do we start something together? It doesn't matter what it is, let's just do something. And we originally wanted to do something like a Yelp for events. So kind of like, what is there to do tonight in Los Angeles? Like, I don't know, like what concerts are playing, what sports games are on, that kind of thing. And there's been probably like a dozen other apps that have done that since, you know, 4 years ago when we did that. But we reached out to agencies, we talked to a lot of engineers, and we just found that in Los Angeles, it was really, really hard to find good engineers. And the agencies that we were talking to, when we, you know, kind of dug deeper into what does the engineering process look like, how do you guys hire, a lot of it was like, oh, hiring's just like, we see if they went to an Ivy League school and, you know, then we hire them. We think they're smart.
Yes.
Like, well, that doesn't show. You know, there's a lot of great programmers that don't come out of Ivy League schools.
Right.
And the training process was just also like, we were like, the product development process of like designers passing designs over to developers, designers understanding what standards, you know, mobile design has, for example. So like a header needs to be X pixels high on iOS versus Android, how to, you know, produce all the different dimension sizes for Android that need to be produced.
Right.
And then when engineering goes into actual production, how that actual production goes back to design and then goes to QA before actually going to launch. Like all that whole process that we had been familiar with because we were kind of like techie engineer guys. We were like, and you know, other people weren't doing. So we were like, maybe it makes sense to like start something in this space.
Hmm.
And like, we don't have to go through the fundraising thing and we can actually have a lot more control over, you know, vision and a lot of the kind of unique things that we want to do. So that's kind of how we got started.
And so, we were talking about this before. You know, you started off like, "Hey, we're going to create products, right?"
Right.
And then, and the company's only what, a couple of years old. Probably,
we're on our fourth year now.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Double what I said.
Yeah.
But you know, and then you're in the midst of a pivot of sorts.
Right.
You know, to align a little bit more on the marketing services side. Am I correct?
Yeah. It's like, how do we make essentially great products for people? So someone has an idea, someone has a target audience, how do we make a great product? So there's a lot of sort of quote-unquote agencies that'll focus on how do we market a product or how do we sell a product. Our thing is like, that's awesome and people are amazing at that and there's a lot of creative people out there, but we want to basically answer the question, how do you create an excellent product? And so I think there's like somewhat of a merger between, you know, building great products and quote unquote marketing nowadays. You know, marketing's still super, super important. And like I said, there's a lot of great creatives out there that are making amazing ads and that have amazing ideas and all that kind of stuff. Our thing is like, okay, you bring us the idea and we will turn this into like the best engineered product we can, you know, make.
And well, how's that, like, in just as a, from, I guess, from a managerial standpoint, right? Like any company that pivots,
right?
And it's not a drastic pivot, right? It makes sense. But you know, people, whether they signed up for a job and they're like, okay, we're doing what now, or even how to go out now, pitch and market that service to a different group that you were going. Like, what are some of the things you've experienced in the pivoting process that you've had to personally adjust to, or, you know, you've either found difficult or maybe even like naturally easy?
Yeah, part of it was like, it was a little bit natural because we were doing a little bit like on the side consulting. Because once people found out you guys are starting a company in technology, they're just like, oh, can you help us like answer some tech questions for us, right? And so we had done that very early on with Qualcomm and NBC, and we just started to figure like, well, we have these two great brands that we can put on our quote-unquote portfolio if we do end up being sort of more of a services company, and like it's kind of a waste not to put that into a brand because sure. It's like we're doing this work, we might as well put it into a brand. And so we just did that, not really thinking this will become the company that we work on eventually. But then I personally just like fell in love with it too, because I always thought like the smartest people work in product, like on the, you know, on the actual, like I'm going to start Facebook or I'm going to start right. Pinterest or whatever. Like they work on one product and they, you know, create this amazing thing. And that's what I wanted to do. I was like, oh, that sounds amazing. And I felt like, you know, service is kind of inferior because it's like, you're always working for your client or blah, 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 blah. But for me, it was like, the more and more I did it, I was like, this is amazing because I'm constantly learning. I'm constantly working on new projects. I get to work with people, which for me is like the thing that I enjoy doing the most. Yeah. And it's strategy, it's tech, it's design, it's all that combined. And it's working across different industries. And I just really felt like I was intellectually growing constantly, which is something that for me, it's just like, how do I constantly grow? And that was like such a great experience for me that we were like, well, let's just make this our thing. And so that we ended up doing that.
That's
full
cool.
Time.
And it's funny because like that, this is the moment your like eyes light up, right?
Right.
Like, you know, this kind of like cross-functional, like, you know, satisfying a sense of ADD, if you will.
Right.
It's like,
yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Like
yeah.
Multiple stimuli, you know, inputs.
Right.
Give us some examples of the outcome, you know, like what, maybe like a project that you're like, you feel like as a crown jewel of what Fisherman Labs is put together.
Yeah. So like one cool thing we're doing this next week is we're working with Regal, HTC and Sony, and for the Resident Evil launch. And one really, really cool thing that we got to do is build this VR experience, which is this zombie game where you put on this VR headset and you're shooting zombies. And if you buy a ticket to like Regal, you get to go to the LA Live and experience this. And HTC is sponsoring it, Regal's on it, Sony's on it, and getting the different parties together and getting people excited about what virtual reality is, which is like this emerging technology that, you know, we all think is going to do something this year. I think people are predicting like 12 million units this year, which compared to like, you know, iPhone sold, I think 200 million units last year. So 12 million is still nothing, but it's something that's emerging and people that have tried it are fascinated by it. For us, we get to create this experience and get so many people interested in something like that. So for us, it's like emerging technology is really like the areas that we work in. So that could be like creating bots or, you know, virtual reality, augmented reality type stuff, you know, mobile apps that are excellent products,
right.
which is new for a lot of companies because most companies used to spend most of their money on TV ads and that kind of stuff. And now they're building products that are interfacing with consumers more. So it's something that, you know, for us is really exciting to get to work on. So we've done that kind of stuff, and then we've done mobile apps. So our history was that our first 2 years we spent most of our time on startups. So we were working with startups that had raised anywhere from 200,000 to around like 2 million, 5 million, and we'd help them on one, either just augmenting their development staff, or two, if they had a development staff already, we'd work with their development staff and try to help them on the product development cycle that I talked about previously. And here's how you run, you know, a Scrum. Here's how you run Agile. And here's how you build software efficiently. And let's do this for 3 months together, train your staff, and then let you guys fly. So that was something that we did with startups for a couple of years. And then we grew to the point where we're like, also funding for startups has really dried up over the last six months to a year.
Yep.
So that's a factor. And also for us, like on the brand side, there's just way more budget to work with a lot of the research and the testing stuff that we really enjoy. So really diving into stuff, whereas startups work on a more agile fashion. So they're trying to move quickly. They're trying to test. They're trying to iterate. And both of those are really valid ways to approach development. But they're different, and we feel like we can learn from both. It's like we can learn from the kind of nimble mindset, but we can also learn from the deep dive research mindset too.
I think that's great. I do a lot of work with big brands and startups and kind of meshing them together, right. Forcing them to work together.
Yeah.
And it's because the expectation and the mindsets are like completely different. And most, especially in today's sort of entrepreneurial culture, like most entrepreneurs haven't had much like corporate experience.
Right.
So, when a client is like, let's have their PR team do it. I was like, there's two people that work at this company, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just these, balancing out these misconceptions. But I want to go back to something that I think is kind of interesting, because were you passionate about finance? Because like I said, your eyes lit up when you start talking about like working with people and like being creative, but then the numbers is like very scientific and mathematical, kind of obvious. But what was it at the time, aside from like having some success at 19, that like money was the thing, or finance was the thing that resonated with you?
Right. I think like I love learning. And if you look at finance and capital markets, there's really an unlimited amount you can learn. Like capital markets are essentially like you're looking at global markets. There's constantly news hitting the wire, right? So you're constantly taking in news. You're looking at what was industrial production this week. What are weekly claims at? And you're constantly taking all this information from a global macro side, and then you're also digging into a company too as well.
Right.
So I think from the trading side, there's just unlimited learning in finance, which was fascinating to me. And then in the investment banking side, which I was in for. A year, 2 years, it's all about advisory, which is in a kind of a sick way, very similar to what I'm doing today.
Right.
Because I was like, I never want to do this again. And like, I'm still like working for clients doing advisory, but just in tech. So people are like, isn't finance and like what you're doing today like completely different? I'm like, it's actually like pretty much exactly the same. The main reason that I stepped away from the hedge fund side is hedge funds make money by the movement of money. So, when you make one trade, someone is on the other side of that trade. So there's not a lot of actual production from a creative side that's actually happening.
You're just monitoring, for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a venture capitalist is a little bit different because they're putting risk at work, and then they're also advising the person that they're putting risk capital to. Whereas for a hedge fund, if I don't invest in, X company, Google, someone else is going to invest in Google. It's a pretty efficient market, so you don't have a lot of opportunity to actually impact that company. So Google doesn't care whether X hedge fund puts money into Google.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just, for me, it was like, I want to make impact. I want to be creative. I want to actually, do something. And the hedge fund stuff, it's good from a monetary, you can make money trading, but you're not really doing anything.
Right. It's not as actively creative.
Yeah, exactly.
When you say your mom was a journalist and she was a member of Radiohead, and your dad was a classical composer.
Right.
Your brother's a DJ.
Yep, right.
You're the odd man out. Like, you don't fit. You have other siblings?
No, it's just us, but all my cousins are musicians too, which is kind of funny. Not all of them, but a lot of them are.
So, creatives. Like, why are you such a square peg in a slew of round holes?
I honestly think for me, like, I wasn't a good high school student. I was a horrible high school student. I played a lot of music.
But you're Asian.
I know. Asian with a musician and journalist parents, so it was, like, not typical. But, I wasn't a good high school student. I played a lot of music, and I played a lot of video games. That's, like, what I did when I was young. But I felt like those two things grew my my love for technology. And music is one of those things which it's kind of sad to me that music programs are being cut across the country because of budget issues, because I really felt like for me, music took me to a place where I felt like my brain was like growing. Like once I got to a certain point, I was like, there's a lot of interesting intersections between music and math and music and other disciplines that I felt like it was very hard to be tangible. But when I grew older, I felt like I could pick things up faster than other people.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of that, I think, I mean, that could be just like some crazy,
But that's the science behind music, right? That's
right.
The one of the biggest arguments about, you know, against taking music out of schools.
Right.
What were some of your early, like, what were you listening to at the time? Like, in your video game?
I mean, I listened to so many different things because of the background. Like, mm-hmm. I listened to, you know, U2 and Radiohead and those kinds of music early on, which was like kind of my thing. And then my parents would force us to listen to classical and that kind of and jazz.
Yeah.
They're huge classical and jazz fans. And I hated that stuff early on because they'd turn it on the radio, we'd driving around. I'm like, oh my gosh, this sounds so bad.
I think every kid hated like that experience. I had the same thing. My mom used to listen to like some jazz station in Detroit. I'm like, please turn this off.
Yeah. But now I'm like, I have classical and jazz playing on my radio when I'm driving around, which is hilarious. And I'm like, I love this stuff, you know? And I'm like sending my dad like these classical pieces now. So it definitely had an impact on me. And I probably subliminally liked it, but didn't want to let my parents know that I liked it. And I think music to me has a lot more relationships to the things that we do today, which are, I mean, for me, my job today is pretty much around connecting people and creating relationships and being creative and coming up with like kind of innovative things to do.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what, you know, my parents are doing, well, my mom now, she's running, well, she was the director of Voice of America, which is like some 3,000 person organization. So she's like not just on the journalism side. She's sort of on the business side now as well.
Sorry, I didn't mean to downplay your mom.
No,
she's awesome. Happy Mother's Day.
Radiohead. And she played for Radiohead.
Well, it's fun. I'm having fun like jumping back and forth in your timeline, right? Because, you know, when you and I met, it was like you handed me your card, and I was like, Fisherman Labs, right? Remember this conversation?
Yeah.
And I was like, are you a believer? And you said, yes. And we had this whole conversation about church and Jesus and you know, just like how that's fit into your career path. And also, you know, it doesn't sound like the religion was part of your childhood.
No,
so
it wasn't.
You know, so how did that happen? And then we'll like later we'll kind of talk about like how it manifests in the work you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up in sort of my parents were like liberal in the sense that they, and I use that word liberal to mean that they wanted us to explore and figure things out for ourselves. And the interesting thing is they were religious in the sense that they were praying for us, and they had actually come and pray for us a lot. But we lived in Hong Kong for a period of time. We came back, and me and my brother were just not interested in church. You know,
right.
We were just, I don't care, like, why am I going to go to church, you know, like, it's just boring. I fall asleep. You know, I'd rather go play sports or play games or do anything except for go to church. And so that was my background. And my parents just let us do what we wanted to do. So we didn't go to church. We just hung out. My brother actually went down a darker path where he was selling drugs, stealing cars, actually. I mean, he's talked about this in the past before too.
Oh no! It was funny. Small world.
Watch
is,
out.
No, small world is like we like he's a mutual friend. Well, he's obviously your brother.
Yeah,
but he's my wife DJs and like they've done a bunch of gigs and stuff together. So he's been at the house and everything.
Yeah, so he's got this crazy background too, where he was stealing cars, you know, just crazy doing drugs. He was an alcoholic for a while. And
so he had all the fun.
He had a lot more fun than I did. Yeah, let's just put it that way. Yeah, and I grew up wanting that for myself because I saw like, man, my brother's like, people love my brother. He's got a crazy personality. He's super loving, super friendly, and people just love his kind of charismatic, personality. So I wanted to be, you know, the bad boy too and do all that kind of stuff. So I grew up kind of like going to the mall and we'd steal a bunch of stuff from the mall and come out and see how much stuff could we get. I mean, that was my background though. And my dad was teaching in Taiwan for a little while and my mom was working like a ton. So it was just me and my brother and we would just go to the mall after school. Like we weren't doing homework or any of that stuff. So we were just totally not interested. And I got introduced to church because I was playing in a basketball league. Again, my sweater says sports.
Yes.
Love sports.
Generally, I love sports.
Yeah, I just love sports. Yeah. So, I started playing a basketball league, and the youth pastor that was the pastor of this church or the youth group was like, hey, come to Wizards games, because he'd always get past these season tickets from the Wizards. I was a huge Wizards fan. And I was like, sweet. You know, they were like good seats, too. So I was like, you know, and Michael Jordan was playing then for the Wizards. Right. Oh, yeah, so it was like, yeah, it was rad. Like,
it's a rare moment in time. Yeah. You had this experience.
Yeah, so it was great. And I developed a friendship with him. And he invited me to go on this sort of like a missions trip to Nashville where they were, we were working with kind of low income. And in this project, and there's a few people that had moved into the low income neighborhood, these projects to basically, two of them moved from Germany. So they barely spoke English. It was pretty crazy. And one of them was this, this amazing singer that, from Florida that had this job, and he moved into the projects in Nashville. And I met these people and I thought, these are the most joyful people I have ever met. Like they're in the morning, they're sweeping the floor, they're singing songs in German. They're like, right. You're like, what are these guys doing here? You know, why are they like, why are they here? Why are they so happy? And that really just like locked into my brain. And when, I went back home and I could not like get that picture out of my head. Like the joy of just working in the hood and the projects and my life, which seemingly I had a lot of friends. I was, had everything I wanted. We were stealing. We were having fun. We were playing video games. We never really had to go to school because my parents were just not around and they didn't care too much. Like,
you were living the dream.
Yeah, I was living the dream for a high schooler, you know? And
that's a life I want now.
Yeah, exactly. but I was like, how are they happier than me? And maybe they're, and I kind of always knew, I think there's probably a God. To me, all this stuff around cognition and, you know, me having awareness and making, you know, making decisions that aren't rational, there has to be something there.
Right.
And it was a longer step to not believe there was a God. So I kind of knew that already. I was just kind of like, I don't really care. I'd rather just like hang out with chicks and, you know, play video games and, you know, do my phone thing, play sports, you know, all the stuff that high schoolers want to do. It really made this impression on my mind that there's joy that comes from this relationship with God. And I started to read a bunch. So I read all about Buddhism, because I was like, I'm Asian, so I should read about Buddhism, I think. And
start at home first.
Right, exactly. And, I read this one book that C.S. Lewis wrote called Mere Christianity, and that laid out Christianity to me in a way that I had never, you know, heard about religion before. So I read that. It had a huge impact on me in terms of kind of the answer to the problems and evil in this world, and the answer to the goodness and love in this world too as well. I didn't see anything that answered those two things and the problem of like guilt. How do you deal with the guilt and shame that we all struggle with? And how do you deal with the joy and love and that humans have for each other? But they're also killing each other too. Right. So it's like that tension I felt was so well communicated in the gospel, in the message of Christianity. So that's when I got interested in Christianity. And, you know, as soon as that happened, I wanted to be a youth pastor. So it took a turn in college, but
So what period of time was that? Was it like a 2-week process or was it like a year? Like from the time you went to the German sweeping the floor?
It's probably like 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
It wasn't like, you know, the next day I was, you know, I still.
Next day I was baptized.
Yeah. I was actually just telling my wife the other day, I remember the last time that I stole because, you know, I was stealing all the time. And I remember I was like spending a lot of time with this girl in New Jersey who I knew.
That's
before.
The problem, right?
Right.
There.
Yeah, that's a problem.
problem. That's where girl. You went wrong.
Yeah, you know, we were like kind of like sleeping together, that kind of thing. And then I took a bus back from Jersey back to Maryland. And I remember I stopped in a convenience store. And this is like maybe a month after the thing I did in Nashville.
Right.
And I stole a candy bar or something like that. And I think I stole something else. And I walked out of the convenience store. I walked in the bus and I had been thinking about Christianity a lot, but it hadn't really clicked for me yet. I was still stealing. I was still with this chick. And
right.
I was like, I can't do that anymore. You know, I just really felt convicted by that.
Right.
And I never stole again after that. So it was just, that was quick, but there were a lot of other things that, you know, it wasn't like, for me, I'm a very like, I need some type of rational arguments and things like that. So I needed to study things for it to be more real for me. It wasn't like this emotional thing. So everybody's a little bit different.
Well, it's interesting, you know, I think when people have an opposition to religious points of view, I'll just phrase it that way.
Right.
you're like, you're also very intellectual with it, right? Like you like you said, you've read, and most people will quote the Bible, right? You right. said C.S. Lewis, you read about Buddhism,
right.
like you were just kind of like absorbing the entire ecosystem, and I right. think that, you know, the silly thing, thought phrase that came to my head, it gives you like a little bit of a superpower, and especially in terms of being able to have a convert, like an intelligent dialogue, because
right.
most people who are like Bible thumpers, if
right.
you will.
Yeah.
It's like their conviction isn't wrong,
right?
But it's not like it's not an intellectual point of view,
right? And some people are more moved by feeling than intellect,
of course.
And you know, humans are all different, and we're complex. And I'm sure there was an emotional side of it as well. But you know, for me, I'm sort of like a pessimist slash like. I question everything. Like it's really hard. So it's really hard for the fact that I'm like, you know, I don't know what you might call it, spiritual, whatever.
Sure.
Is kind of, you know, interesting because there's, you know, huge potential for me to just like question. You know, I think being good at something business related or being creative, a lot of that is the ability to question things.
Well, you know, it's an innate curiosity,
right?
You know, and I think that's what, you know, I just gave a talk on this a few months ago, and you know, I listed out some of the principles of innovation, and one of them was like this: just be curious, like
right.
ask questions.
No,
you don't have to challenge everything,
right.
but just ask a couple of layers deep,
right?
You know, and that happens.
Yeah, I have like this whole notebook. My wife like just jokes about it all the time that I keep that is just about things that don't work that should. And then the other half of that is just business ideas. And I have like literally hundreds and hundreds of things that don't work. Like every day I'm just pissed off about something. Like, what is it, you know, the heater and cooling system, why are they so big? You know, they're like these huge like
right.
HVAC systems outside of homes. Or like, why does artificial grass suck? And like, why is it 50? Like someone quoted me $15,000 for artificial grass. I'm like, this is plastic green stuff that you're $15,000, you know, and you just start to think about that. And like, people are like talking about a drought in California, and you're like, why is water an issue? We live next to an ocean.
You know, you're like, that's mine.
Yeah, right? You're like, everything. Like, and you know, that could be from software to anything, right?
It makes you sound like a joy to be around.
Right. Yeah, it's fun. It's entertaining, I'm sure.
I love this. So, Fisherman Labs, you can teach a man to fish or lead him to whatever. Where does the, poetically, where does that, the you know,
right.
or does it fit into your
No, it
your
does. You know, the really funny thing is I hate seafood. And people, you know, we did like a SWOT analysis.
Why does seafood have to come from the sea? Like the,
right.
that's one of your questions.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, no, we did like a SWOT analysis for our partners the other day, and people, one of the weaknesses of mine was like, he doesn't eat seafood, he can't go to business dinners. I'm like, how's that a weakness? But no, I mean, the fisherman thing to me, I think no matter what you think about Christianity, the most impactful group in the history of the human race was these 12 apostles of Jesus. And Jesus and, you know, these 12 people, you know, most of them were fishermen. That's what they did as a profession.
Right.
And then Jesus told them to go fish for men. And that from a political standpoint, from philosophical, from culture change, like our cities are named after, you know, these religious things. Our names come from you know, these people, Peter, Paul, and these people. And these people had such wide influence across culture. You know, they influenced the early Roman culture all the
right.
way to all of Western culture, all the way to now Eastern culture. The fastest growing place that Christianity is growing is in the East now, you know, and in Asia and Africa. So all that huge impact, like you can argue about whether it's true or whether it's false, but if you just think about impact over time, like these people had massive impact. And I think that's like ultimately what we're interested in. Like, how do we make impact? We get the opportunity to come alongside C-level executives and entrepreneurs, and we get the opportunity to advise them on what they should do next. And that to us means we get a lot of influence on hopefully advising them to make great products and
yeah.
things that are, you know, excellent. So I think that to me is the tie. Like these fishermen that didn't know much but ended up writing the stuff and, you know, impacting these people became this huge influential group. And that's powerful. No matter like what you believe about it, it's a powerful to look at the impact that they had.
Well, do you ever think about like the domino effect of what you're doing? You know, yes, you get to impact people in a room or in a moment, but I also like to think, you know, when I work with innovation teams, I also feel like sometimes just your thinking may influence somebody in a way that you didn't even consider and you will probably never even see.
Right.
Right.
Like, yeah, totally.
There's this moment where you're like, and I think that's kind of like, I think the disciples were just doing what they were doing in the moment. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were thinking about the long-standing global impact of, you know, the world impact.
Yeah, I'm
but
sure they had no
it
idea.
Happened.
Right.
So, like, do you ever, does that thought ever cross your mind, or you try to stay in the moment, like when you're when you're having these creative brainstorms and problem solving sessions?
No, I mean, I probably think about that probably more than they did. I'm sure they, you know, they were in the middle of the Middle East, like, you know, not even like a big city.
Right.
Like, you know, I can't imagine how they could ever imagine what would have happened with a movement like that. You know, for us, I think we're intentionally trying to impact people. So I think there is like more intent there.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know. I try to like, I think there's probably more planning that happens in a business than those guys were doing. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe they were doing a lot more planning than I thought. But,
well, by the way, I would argue that the other influential group of roughly 12 individuals is the Wu-Tang Clan.
There you go. Yeah.
Control Collective exists to inspire. We are a home for aspiring and established entrepreneurs looking to create, mold, and shape the future. The environment we create is purpose-built to inspire innovation and propel new ideas. Well stated. What did I just read?
So that's kind of like the mission statement of Control Collective. So we have an interest in this co-working space. It's based in Playa, but we just opened a co-working space in downtown. And
a second one, right?
And we're there's a few other ones in the works right now, in throughout LA. And we want to be this brand in LA around, you know, building community, you know, building innovators, supporting people that are trying to do impactful things. And we Charles and I, when we were running Fishman, I got to meet David originally, David Brand, who's the kind of founder, and then Talia, who's a CEO, also founder of Control Collective, and we met them. I met David originally, and we had conversations back and forth, and we just hit it off. We're like, man, we have a very similar vision on what we want to do. Fisherman at the time was thinking we need to go out and like buy an office, or we wanted to like be in a location. So what does that look like for us to either buy an office or rent an office or maybe do some type of co-working thing? And you know, because part of our thing is how to be impactful, how to create community, and those are all like important values of our company.
Sure.
Co-working seemed to make a lot of sense, but running a co-working space is very, very difficult. So it seemed to work very well where we could come alongside and partner with Control. And they were looking for investors, they were looking for partners as well. And so we just really got along and we became kind of like partners with Control, our company. So we're housed out of there. And it works really, really well because we're an agency and we do work for brands, but we get to operate in this bigger ecosystem of, you know, 200 plus events a year at our Playa office.
That's amazing.
You know, we're involved in the planning of some of those. We're involved in trying to going to them and interacting with people. But we also, you know, run our own company too as well. So it's a great kind of fit for us. And, you know, we've been there for about just over a year now, or maybe it hasn't been that long, but it's been about a year now. And yeah, it's been awesome.
What's the Eden Chen definition of community?
I think like community to me is, being able to, give to somebody without necessarily, community to me is like true friendship, right? Authentic friendships with people. And that usually means liking your time with someone and not necessarily doing it because you're getting something in return, but because you enjoy the presence of that person.
Mm.
So I think like inauthentic communities are when, you know, everyone's there because they're trying to get something out of it, which, you know, that's the initial point for a lot of relationships, which is fine because, you know, if it's hard to even make contact with someone without some reason for that. But beyond that, it's like, man, I enjoy this person. You know, I really enjoy their personality. I enjoy learning from them. And, you know, that there's that mutual respect both ways. So I think that across many, many different people is what we're trying to create. So like Control Collective, for example, a big portion of the control spaces, if you've been there, are open space, which is different from a lot of other co-working spaces where a lot of it is private office. And it tends to be just like a huge building with a lot of private office spaces.
Right.
With Control, it's a big open space. There's tons of events. Members get to go to the events. And that forces some level of community just by nature of
like... Do people like that, though? Like, there's always a balance between, like,
right.
I need to make a phone call, or I don't want anybody to see what I'm working on. Like,
totally. Yeah,
and there's some practicality to that. So, like, right. where does that part play into it? Because co-working spaces are... it's obviously a growing right. area of yep. business practice. But, you know, there is some reservations, whether it's a generational thing
totally.
Or just, like, I don't get it. Like, but what do you...
Yeah, there totally needs to be a balance. So we have rooms. We have like 5 rooms in the open space that you can just go into that are like sort of like phone booths. There's TVs in there, and you can just sit there and work and reserve those rooms.
Yeah.
And anybody can reserve those rooms, and it's part of your membership. So it's one of those things where you want the open space because there's community that's driven there. But if you need to go and work and you don't want to be disturbed, you go in one of the rooms and you just – crank out. Or if we have a meeting, for instance, I mean, we have meetings all the time as an agency.
Right.
We have access to all these different meeting spaces. So every time, so part of our process is anytime we have a client come in, we have rooms booked. Or else we would just be in front of like 100 other people and they'd be listening to what we're doing.
Exactly.
So totally.
So we're going
to
give you $1 million.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's cool. So you mentioned these events, like give us an example of one, because 200 plus, like, it could be very repetitive if it's the same thing, but to program yeah. that is like a whole other beast in and of itself.
Totally. I mean, there's like, so we do, you know, it's your standard kind of like dev events where we're doing like, kind of like learning JavaScript, and you can go and, you know,
sign me up.
Yeah, exactly. Be with a bunch of people that want to learn JavaScript, right? Or like growth hacking 101. You know, you have those kinds of things, and you have like kind of funny stuff like bring your dogs and like dog community. And they have like, you know, like, oh, there was a day where we had like 100 dogs, like I can't remember how many, it was like 120 dogs at the office. And I was like, what is going on? I mean, I'm not down with this, but some people are. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm allergic, so I wouldn't.
Oh, yeah, exactly. There you go.
No, that's super cool. As we sort of wind down a little bit, you get to see a lot. You're also curious. You're also intellectual. You're also an overachiever, which I hate about you. you're 29, is that right?
29, yep.
Yep. You know, it's funny. I got called for a 40 under 40.
Nice.
2 days after my 40th birthday.
Oh, you're too late.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I was like a day off. Matter of fact, it was one of those things. It was like, how old are you? And I was like, why? Why? What's up? And then it was like, I was like, my birthday, I just turned, it was like, you know, the 6th. And the person didn't respond. Like, they didn't respond
wow.
to the email. But later
ageism.
I had a conversation with, exactly.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. I get it all. Age, race, sense of humor.
Right, yeah.
So you've seen a lot. That's where I was going. The show's called Innovation Crush. What are you currently crushing on? You've talked about AR. You've talked about Jesus. You've talked about, you know, startups and money. Like, what is something right now that's kind of like on your mind? And you're like, oh my gosh, I can't get that off, and I have a huge innovation crush on that.
Yeah. So something that my wife and I are super super passionate about is community. Well, we love Los Angeles first of all as a city. But, you know, I have a passion for community. I just kind of talked about that a little bit. But so we, about 2 years ago, intentionally moved into South Central. We came out of this environment where, like, I personally became Christian because I was working in a low-income environment and, you know, serving people in low-income environments, and found so much joy in doing that. And I spend most of my day working with clients, you know, innovating, coming up with kind of cool solutions and, you know, working on making an app or a website and things like that. And I love that, and it's so fun. But part of me, like, really missed also spending time with people that are not inundated in tech all the time,
yeah.
you know, and they, you know, they go out on their street and sit on the porch and they're saying hi to their neighbor kind of thing. And something about Los Angeles that's really unique about this city is that it's a city of neighborhoods, right? So you could be in South Central and experience one type of neighborhood, then you could go to Beverly Hills and experience a completely different neighborhood, and then you could go to Hollywood and where we are now, and it's totally different. Every neighbor, Venice is different, Silver Lake's different. You have all these different neighborhoods, and each one has its unique personality. And the cool thing about South Central is a lot of the people that live there have been there for 20 years, 30 years, been there since the 70s. And they all know each other by first name basis. I have, like, amazing stories to tell about how my neighbors have served me being there. We're, like, the only Asian people in, like, maybe 3-4 mile radius. And people just love on us. And you hear all these bad stories about South Central and gang violence and all that stuff. And some of that is true. But a lot of the stories that are about how people love on each other isn't – that's not talked about. And,
right.
So I think, like, you know, definitely passionate about – seeing inner city development happen. I'm passionate about seeing minorities get into technology and get opportunities to, you know, all the, we had for a while about 20 kids from the local neighborhood coming over to our house, and none of the 20 kids had stable fathers at home. So for me, just even empirically looking at my neighborhood and the problems why a lot of young black men in my neighborhood get involved in gang violence and selling drugs and using. A lot of it has to do with a lack of male, mentorship and influence. And, you know, there's great moms but they're working like two jobs and they're trying to do all this stuff for their kids. And their kids are just out and about during the day. And we had, you know, about 20 relationships with about 20 kids, and those kids, none of them have fathers. We would have them by our house, and we'd cook like pizza, and we'd like put vegetable toppings together, and we'd all eat together and enjoy like a meal together. And they'd see like me serving my wife, like opening the car door for her, you know, when we went in the car, and it was something that they had never seen before. So that's like this unique opportunity, I think, to like, there's a lot of need for people to take risk, and you know, people do it in business all the time.
Right.
Because it's fun and it's joyful and I love it.
Why do you think more people don't do that? Like, I think, again, and this comes up, this is a theme on, you know, in a lot of these conversations, a lot of us think about doing the thing.
Right.
And then some of us do the thing. Right?
Right, yeah.
You know, what's the difference between you and the other person next to you who thought about it?
Right.
You know, that drove you to, you know.
I think you have the media, first of all, that kind of, like, skews some things in people's minds.
Yeah.
And people forget that people are just people. You know, if, whether you go to one neighborhood or another, people are people. There's good people everywhere. There's bad people everywhere. And there's goodness in people. There's a deep goodness in people and a deep evil in people, too, as well. And I don't think those things are talked about enough. And I don't think people are a lot of times willing to take a risk on behalf of another person without getting something back in return enough. And I think what people don't realize, though, is that we get, like, a lot of people are like, oh, you guys are so, you know, cool because you moved down, but whatever. And for us, it's like, no, we actually really enjoy this. This is not a,
right.
This is not like a PR thing for us. Like, we enjoy our neighbors. We enjoy the kids that we get to interact with. We enjoy the local church that we go to. That's like a 25-person church plant. We enjoy those things. And it's refreshing. And it challenges a lot of my assumptions with, I'm constantly around this tech community, and I love that work, and I enjoy it, and it's what I want to spend my life doing. But at the same time, experiencing another world gives me a different perspective, and it honestly helps me as a person. It helps me think more creatively. It gives me joy, and a lot of people don't see that aspect of it. So it's just feels just like sacrifice, right?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I grew up in Detroit, and case in point, Detroit is one of the cities that gets a bad rap.
Right.
And granted, there are some crazy things that happen there. And there's also, like, especially now, there's like some amazing things happen. And people like gravitate towards the destruction porn. And, you know, and so to challenge that story. But also, I think, like you, in my creative work, it's like, you know, when I think about the thing that I'm thinking, it's supposed to be general market.
Right.
I'm like, all right. Like you mentioned, the VR penetration,
right?
You know, like, I think we over sensationalize it when we talk to ourselves as an industry,
right?
Yeah. And then he's like, "Yeah, but there's Boise, Idaho." I spoke at a conference; there were 1,500 people in the audience,
right?
And like, I had a slide, and I was talking about VR, Baskin Robbins. I was talking about ice cream. I was talking about VR. And I was like, by the way, how many people here have tried a VR experience? Three people raised their hand.
No, it's
and
the penetration's it was, crazy.
And so you start to think about, like, your perspective is from this neighborhood and, like, an intrinsic human need at a core. But also, like, yes, all right, when we're creating this product or this service via this client, then, you know, you have a broader perspective on that, that potential impact.
Yeah, and I think, like, empathy to me is one of the most powerful design mechanics out there in terms of, like, if you want to be a great designer, you need to have empathy for people. And, you know, we're constantly thinking about design solutions. How do we create amazing product? If you want to create an amazing product, you have to design it in a way. And I think, you know, a lot of there's a term that's sort of like empathetic design. And, you know, there's a lot of like agencies out there that are producing work that it the thing looks really, really good. But then just because something looks good to what we think should look good doesn't mean the general population will love it.
Right.
Which is, you know, shocking to us as, you know, creatives, designers.
Borderline offensive.
Yeah. It's like, no, people don't love great design. Well, it's like, well, what is great design? You know, design means like understanding someone and being able to design so that they feel like the product that they're using is both usable in the sense that it's obvious, like they know they're not getting lost in it, and it looks good to them too. And that's a hard thing to do because we have such a, you know, vast population. But if you don't understand people, you're not going to be a good designer.
Right. Right. Last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Ready? Why are you, you have a suspicious smile on your face?
I don't know this. This is really like,
complete this phrase.
Okay.
Innovation to me is.
Innovation to me is. I think it's doing something new. Obviously, I think that's like your textbook definition. But I think to me, if you innovate well, you're surprising people. I think that's where there's an element of surprise and excitement that comes with true innovation. So I can't remember who talks about this, but they talk about a product needs to, in order for a product to really take off, it needs to be like 10x better, right? Because the switching costs of something that's 2x better is just not worth it. But if something is 10x better, you have a huge incentive to switch and like Uber versus taxis, for example.
Right.
You know, the experience is so much better, not just on like, you know, the quality of the car and that, but it's the timing. You know, you're not calling a phone number, you're showing up. There was a water bottle early on and you got all, I mean, it was such a great experience.
You felt like a baller. Like that was when Uber first launched and it was just black cars.
Right.
And I was like, ooh, like I got, I'm in a black car. Like it was just,
you know. It's convenience, it's comfort. It's like there's so many different elements to that. So the true innovation that's happening, I think there's an element of shock and surprise to it that really catches you off guard. And then you're like, I'm interested in checking this out. I'm interested in trying this. And I think, you know, too many times we kind of just are willing to do a little like 1.5x better. But what we really need to do is like think of a completely new paradigm on how to, you know, really shock people with an amazing product. I mean, we all the time look at like Fortune 500 apps just because, you know, we use apps as examples. I mean, these people are spending millions of dollars on these applications that just basic issues are there where like, you know, like for example, Google says that like engagement with the hamburger menu on mobile is something that should never be used. Like hamburger menus engage way lower than bottom menus. So unless you want to hide something, you generally do not use a hamburger menu. And then if you already use a hamburger menu, you usually see that hamburger menu on the top left. So the consumer is expecting to see a hamburger menu on the top left of their app. Now there's apps that put hamburger menus on the top right, you know, for no reason.
Right.
And users are used to seeing, you know, header sizes of, you know, of apps at a certain, you know, height, and people don't, and also buttons need to be a certain height, or else a user's automatically going to realize something's off with this, and they don't know what's necessarily wrong, but something's off, and like all these little details add up to like a great application. And if you're just kind of focused on like let's make something pretty and put it together real quick and let's launch it, then you're not 2x better, you're nothing better. You're like just status quo, and most stuff out there is like
best.
That. Yeah, right. Yeah. You're different at best, and maybe you have some. And a lot of people are like, we need an app, and like we're a big company, we need an app. You know, we're Chick-fil-A, we need an app. You know, Chick-fil-A app is actually really good, but we're Chick-fil-A, we need an app.
And Chick-fil-A is
yeah, it's very, very good. Yeah. This is sponsored by Chick-fil-A. No,
this episode.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, touching every detail and making sure that it's perfect and that things are the way that they should be, and you're doing the research and you're doing the testing, it takes things to a whole nother level. And
yeah.
That, you know, that's what we really want to do as a company too as well.
All right. Where can people find out more about you or Fisherman Labs? Where can they, you know, where should they Googles? Where does the Googling happen?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of Fisherman Labs out there, so you can Google Fisherman Labs. You can find me just Eden Chen on Twitter. That's probably what I use the most, which is sad because no one uses Twitter anymore. Anybody can email me too.
Speaking of Twitter.
Oh, yep.
Yeah. When you posted your thank you about your 30 under 30 in Forbes, you, most people will be like, thank you, Forbes, for the shout-out. You thanked your team. Kudos for that. I thought that was – it's one of those small, like, differences. Most people are like, oh, thank you, Forbes, and, like, not realizing, like, there were 10 other people that helped you get to where
right.
You
were. Right. No, I mean, I honestly feel, like, bad about it. It's, you know, to something – it's like, in one hand – my role in the company is to sort of like be out there and to be in front of people, but just because I'm in front of people and get credit, and it doesn't mean that there's not like a ton of other people. I almost feel bad for my team in some ways when stuff like that happens, because it's like people see me, but there's so many other people that are doing things. I want everybody to be seen, you know.
Yeah,
so
I think if you're the one opening the door, that's totally fine. But I think the fact that you had the, you know, the wherewithal to like do that in a public moment, I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, we have an amazing team, so they're kudos to those guys.
Yeah, screw them. Everyone, yeah. This has been another installment.
On
of
that
the-
note, screw those guys.
Screw those guys.
Eden Chen for life. Yeah, started my own company. Eat, see you guys.
Yeah. Anyway, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.